1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 174, Joy Lies in Another Direction, Unibley's Call to Leave Babylon and Build Zion, paper by Boyd Peterson with comments by Fred K. Christensen.
From Fred Christensen during this session. Boyd is a PhD student in of comparative literature at the University of Utah. He is a teacher of literature at BYU. He's a good friend. I think you all will enjoy hearing from him today. We're going to give Boyd 40 minutes. We're going to give Fred about 10 minutes, and then we'll have some time for some questions and answers. Boyd.
Well, I got a slideshow for you today, so we'll try to keep you from falling asleep. Here's number one. Let's see if this works. What do you know? On March 27, 1915, to celebrate his fifth birthday, Hugh Nibley went with his family to his Uncle Louis' boathouse on the Willamette River in Oregon. Nibley said this was the greatest treat in the world, going down to the boathouse on the river. There, his uncle gave him a birthday present that most five-year-olds at that time would have surely considered a fine gift, five shiny new pennies. But Hugh Nibley was not like most five-year-olds. In a private moment of contemplation, little Hugh took his birthday pennies and dropped them solemnly into the lake, one by one, reflecting on each one. There's no loss there. What's money? That's how I spent my fifth birthday, Hugh later recalled, philosophizing. Hugh Nibley's attitudes about money have changed little over the years. He's had little use for it, and as he saw its effects on his family, he came to regard money as a very corrupting influence on people. Yet it wasn't until rather late in his life that Nibley forcefully addressed the theme in his writings. Despite his negative feelings about money, when he did speak on this theme, it was with hope for the future, whether anticipating the subject of his last public discourse, as he did in his contribution to 1971's last lecture series, or contemplating breakthroughs he would like to see, as he did in 1984's Spheres of Influence speech, both delivered at BYU. When Hugh Nibley has looked to the future, the theme has always been the contemporary affluenza that binding the Latter-day Saints to Babylon, and the hope that we'll begin living the law of consecration and working to establish Zion. It was not until 1989, however, that the publication of Approaching Zion is fully accessible to members of the church outside the BYU community. Since then, Nibley's words have had an immense influence on many individual lives. But Hugh Nibley himself has been consistently approaching Zion since he was a child. Surely Nibley wasn't born with his attitudes about wealth. Someone must have influenced him at a very early age. However, it's very difficult to trace that influence to any one source. He has recalled on several occasions the significant influence of his grandmother Sloane, and he's described her as having been both practical and very generous. Quote, she just gave everything to everybody. She didn't keep anything. She was just helping everybody all the time. After reading the tender letters that Hugh sent to her, I know that she was one of the earliest and deepest influences on Hugh's life. Also very early in his youth, Hugh read Thoreau and the Transcendentalists. As a teenager, he spent many summers trying to get back to nature, roaming around the forests of Oregon and California. As Hugh stated in Faith of an Observer, the documentary, I read the Concord School and thought that all you had to do was go back to nature, and I really believed that. Certainly, if Hugh took Thoreau's message of getting back to nature so literally, he must have also taken to heart Thoreau's message of living simply. Likely the person who had the greatest influence on Hugh, next to his grandmother Sloane, was his grandfather, Charles W. Nibley. At the turn of the century, After the turn of the century, C.W. Nibley made a fortune in lumber and sugar beets and became one of the richest men in Utah. He was also the presiding bishop and a member of the First Presidency. Never was an apostle, though. That's kind of interesting. But Hugh remembers him as being a very divided man. His first real love was He was smart, Hugh said, and he had a passion for knowledge, and his real love was the theater. But business took him away from his true passions. C.W. had grown up in the abject poverty of the Scottish mines, where the family had to subsist on roots and potato soup. As Hugh recalls, his grandfather was determined that his kids would never have to go through what he went through. He didn't want them to grow up in poverty. So C.W. felt that making money was absolutely essential. As Hugh stated, C.W. Nibley felt that he had to have money, but he felt very guilty about it. C.W. was very close to Hugh and advised him on many occasions, quote, to hit the Shakespeare, hit the astronomy, and forget the business. Hugh seemed not only to accept the advice his grandfather gave him, but also to resent the money his grandfather would send him. In a letter Hugh wrote ostensibly to thank his grandfather for the birthday check he received on his 17th birthday, Hugh wrote, "As to the check, I can only honestly say that I shall be glad to be finally rid of the profound obligation incurred in the piece of paper signed by the backbone of the imposing Nibley Company." Hugh certainly took his grandfather's advice to heart. Not only did he continue to avoid business, he became less and less concerned with money. Later that same year, oh, this is another picture of C.W. Nibley here with Joseph F. Smith and Hugh's father, Alex Nibley, on the far, let's see, for you it would be the far left. Later that year, at the age of 17, Hugh left for his mission to Germany. On his mission, he constantly wrote to his mother asking her not to send so much money. Now, granted, this was during the days of high inflation in Germany, just prior to the Second World War. Hugh has stated that, quote, a German mark was worth nothing then. A billion marks for a dollar was what it was going for on the market. And naturally, when they'd send me $50 a month, what would I do with that? I could support the entire branch. I had no use for it, so I'd stick it in books and do everything else. Hugh's practice of using dollar bills as bookmarks was beneficial for his more financially strapped missionary companions. One of them reports that when any of the missionaries needed money, they would pilfer through Elder Nibley's books. Hugh's lack of concern for money was also reflected in his lack of concern for clothing and food. One fellow missionary said that at one point, the mission president assigned him to, quote, locate Elder Nibley and help him buy a new suit. While another fellow missionary reports that Hugh's mission diet consisted mostly of the wheat he'd stash in his pockets and would chew while he was studying or tracting. When Hugh returned from his mission, two events helped to solidify his attitudes about money: the loss of his family's fortune and his grandfather, Charles W. Nibley's, death a year later. Hugh's father, Alex Nibley, was likely as good a businessman as his father, C.W., had been. C.W. had put Alex in charge of several major business deals, and the correspondence between the two reveals a great deal of respect, each one for the other. Alex, his wife Agnes, and their children, Sloan, Hugh, Philip, Richard, Reed, and Barbara, lived in a luxurious home in Glendale, California. This is the home. I think it's backwards, though, but you'll have to forgive me for that. It was the first in Glendale with an elevator. And you can see this was not a little bit like Versailles or something. It was not a modest home. Over the garage there, all the rooms over the garage area were Hugh's. He had a whole suite of rooms there. Thank you. So they grew up in this lavish style and entertained the posh society of Glendale and the entire Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. Alex was a real estate developer, and he'd borrowed a significant amount of money to develop a subdivision in Glendale that they called Ross Moyne. As the Depression worsened, the family company was unable to collect the funds owed to them and unable to pay off their loans. And by 1930, the year Hugh returned home from his mission, the family business was destitute, and the family's luxurious home and all their possessions were auctioned off. Throughout the rest of his life, Alex Nibley, this is an early picture of Alex, tried desperately to recover the family's wealth and status, but it was useless. Alex apparently went from one high-risk scheme to another in search of his lost fortune. As Hugh stated, my father was a very good man and could have been very spiritual, but he was totally sunk in business. While Hugh doesn't talk much about the family's loss, it certainly proved to him that financial wealth does not equal security. In Hugh's father's desperate attempts to regain the family's wealth and status eventually affected Hugh in a very personal way. A year after his family's household was auctioned off in November of 1931, Hugh traveled to Salt Lake and visited his ailing grandfather, Charles W. Nibley, at his suite on the seventh floor of the Hotel Utah. C.W. reaffirmed his advice to Hugh that he should stay out of business, and just prior to Hugh's departure, C.W. reflected on some of the things he had had to do as a businessman and confessed that, quote, if an angel were to come through that door, I would jump right out the window. Charles W. Nibley died 1 month later. These parting words with his grandfather had a huge impact on Hugh's life. Hugh later compared his Nibley and Sloan grandparents. Quote, the passion for succeeding and making something of oneself was nowhere as strong as among the poor Scot laborers of the 19th century, and that is the tradition I grew up in. My canny grandparents had seen enough of the world to know two things. One, that nothing can hold you back like poverty, and two, that nothing can fool and beguile you like wealth. That was their rock in a hard place situation. My grandfather passionately sought for both prizes, became very rich, and was a general authority, but he was always ashamed of his concern for money. He was obsessed with feelings of guilt and warned me against taking that way, even though that is where the world's rewards lie. My other grandfather, who was Irish, his grandfather Sloan, and gave up all his wealth when he joined the church and continued to distribute it whenever he never got anywhere or achieved any office. But when the two men were together, which happened sometimes at our house in Portland, everyone, including the two men themselves, knew who the really successful man was. Hugh spent the first half of the 1930s in college, first at UCLA and then at Berkeley. And for the 1936-37 school year, Hugh's final year of graduate work at Berkeley, Hugh received a university fellowship. The cash award would provide for all of Hugh's school and living expenses, but came with one stipulation. He could not seek any outside employment. After Hugh received the fellowship money, his father approached him for a loan. Dad said he needed the money just over the weekend, Hugh recalled, to rescue one of his mining deals. Hugh's mother pressured him too, assuring him that the money would all be back by the following Monday. But Hugh says, I never saw that money again. In an undated letter, which he must have written soon after this incident, Hugh's upbeat tone betrays an underlying cynicism. Quote, we are nicely settled down now, living on apples and brown bread, a monotonous diet, you say, but let me remind you a philosophic one. What a lucky person. Already I would have blown $40 at the International House. That was the house where he was staying before the crisis. But as it is, I have spent virtually nothing, having precisely that amount to spend. I have applied for everything from pearl diving to traveling fellowships. I honestly think the former would be the pleasanter job to land, and eventually and surely shall succeed. In the meantime, I am pleased at being able to feed handsomely on $2 a week, if I had the $2, which I have not. He adds here, one thing I do need worse than food, and that is honey, which is not a food, but an experience in the abstract, a mere essence. You have no idea how many desires that honey satisfies, thanks to my elastic imagination. I have a feeling that our imagination's a little more elastic than his was, but Hugh later remembered this period of his life as a desperate time, quote, when the bottom of the world fell out. I thought, great guns, this is where it ends. But Hugh's despair didn't last long. Soon he was approached by a professor, Herbert Bolton, to translate some newly acquired Jesuit manuscripts from Latin into English. This gave Hugh the funding to continue his education without violating the stipulation of his fellowship that he not take any outside employment. This experience, which Hugh said restored his faith in the gospel, proved to him that the Lord can and will provide. Despite the fact that the translation job allowed him to continue his education, Hugh's budget was very tight. He had to simplify his diet, which probably didn't need much simplification, to eke by on his menial funds. Hugh's close friend at that time, Paul Springer, remembered 1 week during this period where Hugh lived on pigeon wheat. And while Hugh was writing his dissertation, he says he lived on wilted carrots and canned milk. Quote, you see, you could get carrots cheap because as soon as they were 3 or 4 days old, they started to get soft and wilty, and you could go in the back of the store and get them for a penny a bunch. I'd get them, and then I'd get canned milk, which at that time was only 8 cents a can. So I lived on canned milk and carrots for months. Yum. Upon graduation from Berkeley, Hugh sought employment at Claremont College in a fairly unique way. Since he had no experience teaching, he came up with the idea that he would volunteer to teach for free.
as he stated, just for the experience, because then I could have an inside. So I did teach for nothing the first year. I didn't get any pay at all at Claremont the first year. During this period, when Hugh had no income, he subsisted on oranges, which would drop off the trees around Claremont, and cabbage, which cost only a few pennies. Obviously, the Hugh Nibley program for life is not a gourmet program here. Even after he did start to receive a paycheck, it must have been fairly menial, but it was sufficient for Hugh. In a letter he wrote to his mother in 1941, Hugh described his affairs. "I am broke now and expect to stay that way. The austere life is the only one I can enjoy, and you may think it strange, but I find the good, homey atmosphere simply suffocating. May I be boiled in oil if I force a congenial and comfortable home on anyone. If the war keeps up, even this plush-bottom generation may learn that joy lies in another direction and a world far removed from cozy beds and double-rich Sundays." The war did keep up, however, and soon Hugh found himself writing from the war front, from the European campaign where he was in military intelligence. In letters he wrote to his mother at that time, it's apparent that Hugh's attitudes toward money remain consistent. In one such letter, Hugh wrote that, quote, "Money is nothing but congealed wickedness." Likewise, Hugh's father's practice of investing in shady business deals evidently continued. In another letter he writes, "Dad seems remarkably persistent in his attempts to grab a disproportionate share of the riches of the earth. It has taken millions of years to produce that stuff, and the supply is limited. In an earlier day, almost anyone could pull it off, but now it requires a wolf-like cunning and boldness, in which Papa's qualifications are happily far arrear of his intentions." There's another picture of Nibley during the war. Following the war, Hugh spent the winter of 1945 hiking in Utah's southern Red Rock country, and in the spring of 1946, he obtained a position as an editor for the church magazine The Improvement Era. Around this time, Hugh wrote to his friend Paul Springer that, quote, "There are so many things of real importance in life that I can never bring myself to face the nauseating trivialities that, unfortunately, pay off." In April of 46, Hugh signed a contract to teach at BYU. At that time, teaching at BYU didn't pay much, but it did allow Hugh to enjoy something he felt had real importance, Utah's natural landscape. It also forced him to seek another thing of real importance, a wife. Hugh's Spartan lifestyle and lack of concern for material goods must have made early married life a real challenge for Phyllis Draper, now Mrs. Nibley. As Hugh recalls, quote, "I had such low standards. The only furniture we had was this mattress, which went on the floor, and we had two orange crates for the table. And that's the only furniture we had for almost 2 years. It never occurred to me that we'd need anything more." Lovely, huh? Phyllis soon realized that her husband would, as she put it, quote, "prefer not to have anything to do with money at all," and had a denial of the need to manage money. So Phyllis took over managing the family's finances. Nevertheless, she agreed with her husband in principle that material things do not provide happiness, and she has been content with the modest lifestyle he provided. Quote, "I always felt that we had enough to eat, we had enough to make the payments on the house, and so forth. We didn't have a big income, but it was steady, and if you want to manage things, you can manage with that income." And managing with a modest income is something Phyllis had to do with 8 children and a husband who avoided anything that might remotely be related to business. Early in his career at BYU, Hugh was asked to speak at a seminar about leadership. And Hugh responded that, quote, "aside from the fact that I am the world's worst leader, the thing smacks of business, which I find, I might as well admit it, violently repugnant. So you can imagine what kind of speech I would give. Even if I had the time and inclination, it would be full of spite and make your every particular hair to stand on end like quills upon the fretful porpentine." That's Shakespeare, in case you missed it. "That might not be desirable," he says. Needless to say, Hugh did not make many points with local businessmen. At one time, a publisher contacted Hugh and was asking him if he could list him in a book of, quote, successful people. Hugh's response was typical. "I was flattered by your invitation and exhilarated by your sense of humor. To put me in a book of successful people is high comedy indeed. The first time I succeed in anything, I shall let you know, but don't hold your breath." Might I suggest a book of Born Losers, which I honestly believe would contain some far more interesting characters than any top management? The church archives are full of obscure nobodies whose achievements rank with those of Enoch's people. I'm not thinking of the usual heroic pioneers, but those who disappeared in obscurity after leaving tracks in the wilderness. Hugh Nibley has lived a very contented life. He was, as Paul Springer noted, content to eat regularly and have a place to sleep and get his books. He has provided an income and a home for his family, which has been sufficient for their needs. Despite better offers from more prestigious universities, Hugh has remained at BYU because he's remained content with his position and has worried little about his salary. His close friends Paul Springer and Goldsmith one time expressed concern about Nibley's remaining at BYU. They wrote him and said, "We see in you one of the few really first-class minds of these muddled times, voluntarily consigning itself to oblivion." However, Springer eventually felt that Hugh had made a better choice than he had. Quote, "He's doing what he wants, and he gets paid for it. I get paid for doing what I don't want, and I don't get paid for doing what I do want. So in the end, I think his choice was much more wise than my own." Now, perhaps Hugh's attitude towards money is at times a bit extreme. I think Phyllis Nibley's position that money does need to be managed and cannot be completely avoided is much more practical. However, Hugh has done us all, I believe, a great service by calling to our attention the corrosive influence money can have on our lives and urging us to seek instead to build Zion. Now, while his lack of interest and disgust towards money have remained consistent throughout his life, they've also remained primarily in the realm of personal philosophy. His early writings and speeches rarely approached the topic. He first touched on the theme in his priesthood manual for 1957 and approached the Book of Mormon, and later he touches on it briefly in Since Cumorah. But it really wasn't until the 1970s, towards the end that he picks up momentum, that he began to address it forcefully in his speeches and writings. Perhaps the reason he didn't stress this theme prior to that time was that he didn't see much need for it until then among the Wasatch Front Mormons where he lived. Or perhaps it was there all along and was censored from his work by his publishers. Hugh has stated that censorship did in fact occur. Quote, "There is only one thing to censor from my writings. You can say anything you want about anything, but you must never, never, never say anything disrespectful about money, even if it were a verse of Scripture. They would cut it right out." As time went on, though, Hugh became more and more obsessed by this topic, and his message began to appear more and more often in print. That obsession began with his speech, "Our Glory or Our Condemnation," in 1971, and the topic of that lecture was to speak on what would you say if this were your last lecture. As Nibley looked toward that future time, he discussed the 10th Article of Faith and longed for the day when we would build up Zion and abandon the clamor of greed. It was here that he first contrasted Zion with Babylon and lamented the fact that the saints start out building Zion and end up building Babylon. That theme continued and was expanded in his 1973 discourse entitled "What is Zion?" which I think is one of the... That speech he confessed, "All my life I have shied away from these disturbing and highly unpopular, even offensive themes, but I cannot do so any longer because in my old age I have taken to reading the Scriptures and there have had it forced upon my reluctant attention that from the time of Adam to the present day, Zion has been pitted against Babylon and the name of the game has always been money, power, and gain." But I rather think it was the nation's emerging trend toward personal affluence that caused Nibley to begin to stress this theme in his public discourses. In a letter he wrote to his son in 1979, Hugh states, quote, "The winning philosophy throughout the land today, and especially in Utah, is simple and to the point. Whatever takes money from me for whatever purpose is bad, and whatever brings me money by whatever means is good." Obviously, this trend disturbed Hugh a great deal, but he also confessed that there was a spiritual side to his motivation. After giving 1979's speech, "How Firm a Foundation, What Makes It So," at the sesquicentennial lectures on Mormon arts, Hugh confessed in a letter to his son that, "Yesterday I gave the opening talk of a set of sesquicentennial addresses. At the last moment, under strong promptings of the Spirit, I changed the subject and spoke about something that has suddenly become very important to me, the law of consecration. Whatever his motivation, however, the law of consecration became a dominant theme for Nibley during the 80s. During the decade, the period that became known as the Me Generation, Nibley delivered a steady stream of speeches. How to get rich, work we must, but the lunch is free. What kind of work? Leadership to management. We still weep for Zion. Breakthroughs I would like to see, and other essays, all describing the perils of seeking after riches and urging us instead to seek to build up Zion. In these speeches, Nibley has warned us that ultimately we have only two choices in this life, seek treasure here or seek treasure in a heaven. But just as he learned when his family lost their fortune, Hugh knows that the only secure treasure we have are in heaven, and we have no right or reason to be concerned with the other treasures. They don't mean a thing, but the real treasure means everything. He has also noted that seeking for wealth leads us away from spirituality. In a letter he wrote in 1988, Hugh describes the dilemma. We've been instructed to read the Book of Mormon with scrupulous care and close analysis, he writes. If we do that, we will discover that the acquisition of wealth often is rewarded. The acquisition of wealth often rewarded the zeal of saints, but inevitably led to pride, ambition, and the increase of inequality among the saints. It was the inequality that bothered the prophets. Let me refer you to the concordance for checking on these things statistically. Match up, for example, riches and angels, both of which are mentioned many times. The riches tell one story, the angels another. The riches don't bother me because they don't concern me, but the absence of angels on the present scene may be significant. As you know, Joseph Smith said, quote, "The heavens have often been sealed up because of covetousness in the church." But the primitive church, Hugh writes, still went on without angels or revelations, the channel being pretty well closed off. The degree of inspiration in the church today is not always the same. The Book of Mormon is a barometer in which it goes up and down in astonishingly short periods. If you examine it, you will find that there is a definite correlation between wealth and revelation, a negative correlation. You will also find that at every period there are humble servants of Christ who go their way without trying to control anything but their own behavior. They are the ones who really benefit by the gospel and enjoy it. Skipping a bit here. The only hope, Hugh ultimately believes, for this world is to establish Zion. And he sees the law of consecration as, quote, a minimal requirement for our exaltation. It is the last and hardest requirement made of men in this life. Sexual temptations, he argues, are second to temptations of wealth because these temptations, quote, subside with advancing age, while desire for the security and status of wealth only increase and grow through the years. If we see ourselves as God does, as members of a large world family, then, quote, to take more than we need is ultimately to take that which does not belong to us. As Hugh states, we have been sent to school upon this earth, which is a fitting analogy, I suppose, for a professor, with all our room and board freely provided. If we spend that and secure more room and board and more room and board, he will say to us, as he did to the highly successful entrepreneur who expanded his business and achieved delightful security for the business for the future, "Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee." But Nibley has not only called on us to seek Zion, he has reminded us that the law of consecration is both practical and a covenant that we've already made. In one letter he writes, "We forget today how well the United Order worked in many places. United means, by definition, teamwork, cooperation, necessarily requiring a number of people involved in the same project. As in," he puts in parentheses, "Zion's, sick, cooperative, sick, mercantile, very, institution, you name it. Order means that people are following a common rule, all of which says that you can only live the United Order in a cooperative group. You cannot play it alone. The thing must be planned, directed, and controlled from ahead. It is an organization, and as such, it must be properly directed by the head of the church." And yet the law of consecration and the United Order are not the same thing. We cannot live the United Order until the church returns to such planned communities. But we can consecrate all we have to the Lord. As Hugh remarked, quote, "What is there to stop me from observing and keeping the law of consecration at this very day, as I've already covenanted and promised to do without reservation? The plain fact is," he reminds us, "that I have promised to keep a law and to keep it now. I know exactly what I am supposed to consecrate, exactly how, exactly why, exactly when, and exactly where. we often assume that external events will motivate the change in our individual practices, that the establishment of Zion will bring about a return to our living the law of consecration. But Nibley argues that it's by living the law of consecration that we'll establish Zion. Quote, we do not wait until Zion is here to observe the law of consecration. It is rather a means of bringing us nearer to Zion. As Hugh stated in a personal letter, consecration is something only the individual can practice. Quote, consecration is a most intimate, personal, and private law. You cannot consecrate what belongs to somebody else, and nobody else can consecrate what belongs to you without first taking it away from you. Consecrate, as you know, means to set apart, take out of circulation, literally put within an enclosure or behind a fence. It is quite possible, he goes on, to give out all that you have except what you need to live on, having food and raiment, etc. And that is what I do. I leave things to my wife, who is a fanatical giver. Needless to say, there is no shortage of takers. But as Joseph and Brigham both said, it is better to give to 10 impostors than run the risk of turning down one worthy person. Nibley's words seem to be confirmed by the words of our general authorities. Elder Marion G. Romney once stated that we would only establish Zion when we first start living the required laws. Quote, from the beginning, I felt that the welfare program would eventually move into the law of consecration. And this is the trial pattern. Until I can pay my tithing and make liberal contributions of my money and labor, I will not be prepared to go into the United Order, which will require me to consecrate everything I have and therefore give all the surplus for the benefit of the kingdom. I think the United Order will be the last principle of the gospel we will learn to live, and that doing so will bring in the millennium. President Kimball once stated that, quote, the Lord's timetable is directed a good deal by us. We speed up the clock or we slow the hands down, and we turn them back by our activities and our procrastinations. It is only when we are individually living up to the covenants we've already made that we will be able to live those covenants in unison as communities and finally establish Zion. While Hugh Nibley's strong and uncompromising voice has not been heard by all, many individuals are listening. I've met many people who've told me that Nibley's words have affected a tremendous change in their lives. And there's a current movement right now that's one of the fastest growing movements in America outside of Mormonism, the Simplicity Movement, if any of you have seen the Affluenza video or on PBS. It's one of the fastest growing movements in America now, kind of contrasting with the 80s. If, as Hugh stated, quote, every step in the direction of increasing one's personal holdings is a step away from Zion, then Hugh Nibley has been approaching Zion for many years. His words are a call to join him and by so doing discover greater peace and happiness by living simple, holy, and committed lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Boyd. We'll now hear from Fred Christensen, a neurosurgeon from Arizona and a lifelong resident of Salt Lake. Is that correct? Thank you.
How many of you here never met Hugh Nibley? Just a hand raise. Oh, a fair number. Surprised. I never met Hugh Nibley. In the discipline of medicine, the person who comments on a paper's job is to shoot it down. You must try every way you can to discredit, because this is the repartee that finally gets to the truth of the issue. I find it difficult to shoot anything down in Hugh Nibley because I find him absolutely admirable and delightful. And if there were more people like him alive, think what the world would be like. How many more? Half of the people? What would the world be like if everybody were like Hugh Nibley? It would be a disaster, wouldn't it? Yeah, because you see, somebody endowed a chair that Hugh could do these things and lead his eccentric life, and that took wealth, and that took the creation of a capital. And I don't want to talk about Hugh as a person, but about his later philosophy, which appears to be a little bit tinged by his malnutrition in his younger years. The problem, of course, is that Hugh would like us to visit the sick and spend our life doing that. But most people who are sick don't want to be visited. They want to be made well, and that takes MRI scanners and CT scanners, and someone's got to raise $1 million to do this. it's nice to be able to retire in an academic position where everything is made easy for you, but somebody's got to clean up the mess afterwards. And that's the problem I have with Hugh Nibley's philosophy. It's okay to take care of the poor, but how do you take care of them? Seems we've learned the lesson that it doesn't do a whole lot of good to simply give them something and think that that solves the problem. What about creating jobs, wealth, and respectable way that they don't have to be beholden to anybody? Because Hugh was a great translator, languages, history, doesn't give him credentials to become a social economist any more than Michael Jordan can become a nutritionist and sell us the right food that makes us healthy because he can play basketball. Yeah, this is what he seems to want to do in his later life, is to outline a social policy that others should practice. Well, of course, he falls into the same trap that many people do. That is, they find a lifestyle that they like, but they think that everybody else must live it also, that they must conform. And so he begins to become very vocal in advocating this as a social system that would work. Well, why won't it work? Well, it didn't work in Brooks Farm. It didn't work in the United Community. It didn't work in the United Order either. My ancestors were part of some of that, and it was a disaster at the time. It didn't work in the entire communist movement, tried in many different countries in the world. It just doesn't work. And the idea that we'll someday return to the United Order when we become worthy totally discounts the lessons of history. You have to be absolutely blind to think that we ever want to even move in that direction. And are we, as a church, moving in that direction? No, we're moving the exact opposite direction. We're moving in the direction of wealth creation now, aren't we? Well, here's the problem that I see. If you look at the mission of Christ, he was a Hugh Nibley, wasn't he? I mean, he went around as a mendicant, pariah, collecting money. He'd give it to Judas Iscariot, and when they'd find people that are in need, they'd redistribute this money. And we're told that this is the pattern of life, and so Hugh does a beautiful job of that. When we read the Book of Mormon, we find that the lesson over and over repeated is, if you get wealth, you forget about fundamental things, and you go into apostasy, and then you're conquered, and then the cycle repeats and goes over and over again. In King Benjamin's sermon, he says, we've got to treat the poor and give them what they want, not what they need. We must give them everything. That, if you look at the teachings of the church in its early years, it was a community of immigrants coming in, couldn't take care of themselves. There had to be a distribution of that wealth. But then what happens? We get Animal Farm all over again, don't we? We begin to get the people who supervise that money doing quite well. I mean, Joseph had a mansion built for him out of the community funds. He had a nice uniform, finest stallion in the area. They had a boat on the river. Brigham Young at some point was the wealthiest man in Utah. So we find that wealth does get created, like it or not, in these societies where there's supposed to be equality. And, of course, that's what happened in Russia as well. There became the elite rather than the commonality of money. So here's the problem that I see it that Hugh presents to me. We have very definite religious teachings that tell us how we should live, and they don't work. They don't work when applied to society as a whole. They haven't historically. They haven't when applied with the best efforts. So how do we live with that dilemma? And can Hugh tell us anything about that? How do we live with inconsistency? Inconsistency of teachings, inconsistency of practicality. Well, I would submit that that's really what life is about. We spend all of our time trying to get consistency, trying to add meaning to life, and it's a lost cause. It can't be done. And that's part of what life is all about, is trying to live with those things. Well, it'd be interesting to look at Hugh and see what has happened as a result of his efforts. I mean, what kind of children did he produce? Were they as eccentric as he was? Maybe you can help us out on some of that. But I wish that more people were like him. I just hope that he never prevails as a social economist.
I'd like to take a few minutes and maybe field some questions from the audience. Maybe I'll start with the first question. You have to forgive me, I'm a book person. In The Story of the Latter-day Saints, the first volume that was banned and later came back into publication, there was a comment by Joseph Fielding Smith, and in that he made a comment about how he was concerned that the church was spending money in foreign countries and in places outside of America, and he was wondering why we weren't being more concerned about building Zion and going back to Zion instead of trying to build up the kingdom outside of Utah and outside of the United States. From your experience, from working on Hugh Nobly's biography, are you familiar with what he might think as far as what the church is? Does he the old school? Does he feel like we're still going to build a Zion here in the U.S. and in Missouri particularly, or does he feel like Joseph Fielding Smith did as he changed his mind and said that he felt that Zion would be built wherever it would be built and wherever the church would be formed?
I have no idea. How's that? I'll have to ask him. Any other questions? You have to moderate these.
I happen to have been fortunate enough to take courses from, correspond with, and read. And I don't recognize in being able to what Mr. Christensen describes. Would you care to see the characterization of social welfare and so on? And what
you'd like to comment on some of this? Would you like to comment on some of the statements that Fred made about, or respond to some of the statements that Fred made earlier?
Well, there was some evolution in Hugh's thought. When he was at Berkeley and during the war, I think he was very far left. And after the war and after he was in military intelligence, got into Germany and really saw, he visited a concentration camp. He'd done his missionary work there before. And so when he saw what the Germans had done and fascism had done, I think he was so disillusioned. There's letters where he describes Russia as a real force, and he says God has a noble purpose for the Russians. And so I think there was a period of time right after the war where his sympathies were very strong towards Russia. I think that he soon became disillusioned with that program as well. In terms of whether I think Nibley is more concerned with the individual's seeking for wealth as opposed to seeking for benefit of humanity than he is with any kind of global program. I think he'd like to see Zion established, but I've never read anything where he's come up with any plan for how that's done. I think he's more of a philosopher than he is a social architect, if that makes sense. But I do think that, you know, there has been some evolution in his thought, but it's always stayed fairly consistent in terms of what his position is on money. Does that kind of answer your question, or?
Well, partly. What I've heard being described is that Nibley supported a welfare state kind of approach. What I hear Nibley saying is quite different from that. That a consecrated society is one in which everyone has work, not a welfare system.
Yeah. No, I've never heard him say that. You know, he thinks we should just create a dole, but.
Yeah. And which he sees as a liberal
And he often cites those as examples, fourth Nephi, the city of Enoch. I think he cites those examples of societies, very few, where they did work. And Nibley is a literalist when it comes to Scripture. I mean, he sees that as something that's literal history. And so I think he would cite those as you know, historical precedent for the fact that the law of consecration can work as a collective society. Brian?
You've probably touched on this a little bit, but you know, there's a difference in my mind between refusing money and not utilizing money, and you know, the old, I don't know if it's mythological, but you know, when he was talking with Deseret Booker, some publisher, about his book royalties, he just said, you know, who needs them? And there's a difference between refusing money and taking money, working for money, accumulating money, and then redistributing it into the world to benefit mankind. You know, I see a Zion society as a society that actively promotes the creation of wealth and then redistributes it for the benefit of the whole. In your experience with Hugh Nibley, do you see any of that proactive motivation in his life? Does he take money and then give it back into the society, or does he just basically refuse money and forces himself to a low level of existence?
Boyd, can you comment on Hugh Nibley's thoughts, possibly on the distribution of money and the bringing in of money, the differences? Is that right, Brian?
We'll try to get. To said, I think he'd like to have nothing to do with it at all. Phyllis, however, I think has adopted his philosophy and then taken it to the level that you're describing. I mean, she is a phenomenal giver. When I've been over at the house, you know, there's stacks of envelopes from charities. You know, once you give to one, they, you know, get you on the list. And so she has more mail than just about anybody I know of from charities that she gives to. So she's, and he described that in one of his statements. He says she's a phenomenal giver. So I think Hugh ultimately, I think, you know, the fact that his family lost the fortune, that his father, there's some very strong things that his father did that really affected him adversely. And I think he just got to the point where he said, I don't want anything to do with this. Phyllis, I think, on the other hand, has been I'm really impressed with her ability to take the money. And, you know, book royalties, you don't make a whole lot from books. But after you've lived as long as Hugh is, he's going to be 90 next year, and have that many books out, you do start making some money. And, you know, he doesn't care about it. He's never worried about it. But Phyllis, on the other hand, she's phenomenal at distributing that money. So I guess that kind of answers your question. Yeah, maybe we should talk about Phyllis.
Can you comment on his thoughts about the Pearl of Great Price?
Well, I think the way you describe his opinion about the Pearl of Great Price initially is a little bit incorrect. In describing parallels between what he sees in the Pearl of Great Price and what he sees in Egyptian and other ancient sources, I don't think he was trying to say this is a pagan or irreligious source. I think he was trying to say this is a source that dates to that period. Yeah, well, he's got plenty to say about that, too. But I don't think his position has changed on that, whether you like it or not. I think Nibley has always been consistently the Book of Abraham, the Book of Moses. He's been very consistent about stating that that is Scripture and that Joseph Smith indeed did translate it, no matter how it happened. So, you know, again, you may disagree with him, but consistency is one of the things I've really grown to admire about him. And I've watched him. I married his daughter. I should preface it by that. I married his daughter 15 years ago, and so I've gotten to know him fairly well. And I've been amazed as one of the things people would come up to me and ask after they found out that I was married to his daughter was, well, does he really believe this? Because they'd assume that, you know, the public Nibley was a very different person than the private Nibley, and that he was, because he was working at BYU, he was getting paid to say certain things and so forth. But the thing that I've been amazed with is, even with his non-Mormon friends, and he had many of them, he was consistently preaching the gospel to them. I was dumbfounded in ways that I'd probably be uncomfortable talking about the church to some of my non-Mormon friends. He was doing it. Although he wasn't always trying to convert them. Paul Springer, who was a very close friend of his, and they were completely different. Paul Springer was very much, before the war, he was practically a fascist, very strong supporter of Germany. He was also a bootlegger during his days at Berkeley and was supplying booze to most of the college students at the International House. So they were very, very different people, but they were also very close friends. And Paul Springer, and the letters to Paul, he's always talking about the gospel and about what he believes and how he believes it. But Paul Springer once confessed that he asked Hugh one time, "Why don't you try to convert me? I know you Mormons are great proselyters." And Hugh responded to him. He says, "Well, I think the church ought to have some say in whether you come in or not."
Please.
You know, I would have indicated in answering Hugh's question that Paul Springer
is one of the most humble vehicles I have ever beheld. But...
Any other questions? Okay, we're out of time. Thank you for attending. Thanks for Boyd and for Fred for the comments.